we still have too few women in leadership positions. And they can do the job. They can do it better sometimes.
When you walk in a room, you can just see the people judging you, especially if you're dressed the way I'm dressed. But this is me. It's who I am, and I love it.
Last year, on International Women's Day, the WTO community was treated to a special event. Two prominent women in the global economy came together for a candid conversation about women's economic empowerment, gender balance in the workplace, and more. Christine Lagarde serves as the president of the European Central Bank. Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala, of course, is the director general of the World Trade Organization. As we celebrate this year's Women's Day, we believe it's the perfect time to revisit their insightful discussion. Whether you want to listen again or catch up if you missed it, their conversation held at the WTO 1 year ago remains as relevant as ever. It is worth your time. So let's talk trade. Welcome to Let's Talk Trade, the podcast by the World Trade Organization. I am Jana Borges from the WTO's communication team. Eleni Giocos, anchor with CNN International, moderated the conversation between Christine Lagarde and Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala.
Today's International Women's Day, and what better way to celebrate than with two extraordinary women who are at the top, who are ready to fight battles not yet fought. For all of us, for society, and for women. Welcome to Dr. Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala, the Director General of the World Trade Organization, and Madame Christine Lagarde, the President of the European Central Bank. A round of applause, ladies and gentlemen. But for now, I'd like to welcome our host, Dr. Ngozi.
Thank you, Eleni. I can see you're all as excited as I am to have this wonderful day. So let me say a few words about one of the best-known women in the world, one of the smartest, most intelligent, most creative, and I dare say one of the best and nicest people I've known in my entire career. I'll just say a few formal words. They will not describe who Christine is, but you know that since November 2019, she's been the president of the European Central Bank, the first woman to do that job. Between 2011 and 2019, she served as the managing director of the IMF, the first woman to do that job. Prior to that, she served as French economic finance minister from 2007 to 2011, after having been trade secretary from 2005 to 2007. Here I pause because there's a personal note. It was when Christine was the Minister for Trade that I first met her when I was Minister of Finance of Nigeria. We were negotiating to try and do away with the $30 billion in debt that Nigeria owed to the Paris Club. So I led the Nigerian delegation to our first meeting, and in walked Minister Lagarde. And she said to me, "This is my first day on the job as minister, and you're my first assignment." And I looked at her and said, "Well, you know, from the World Bank, I've of course had some dealings with the Paris Club, but this is the first time I'm negotiating this for my country." We looked at each other and said, "Between two women, we'll get it done."
Merci beaucoup. Thank you very much, Ngozi, for greeting me and hosting me in this room, which reminds me of, I guess, the year 2006. And I think I was seated over there somewhere in that corner, because we had a ministerial meeting. And at the time, I was secretary for trade for France. So I was in this room, and I can remember vividly the tough discussions that we had and the failure to agree that we experienced. And I think it is a tribute to the talent of my friend Ngozi that at last, after decades of negotiations, certain things got agreed. And I think that it proves the point that when women want to achieve something, they actually find the way. And that's what happened to us in 2005. She just told you the story of our first encounter. But Ngozi did not finish the story. Because we did get it done, and we did cut a deal. And I compromised, and she compromised, and we had a good understanding, and we thought that we were doing good for our countries. Nigeria and France, the Paris Club, of which France has the secretariat. But guess what? In the meantime, as we were working so hard, after an overnight flight and arriving in the room without her voice, actually, I remember, and Ngozi walked in the room and said, "I'm so pleased to meet you, but I can't." And I thought, that's going to be an interesting negotiation. But the moment figures came to the table, the voice came back. So watch out. You know that. But little did we know that at the time when we were negotiating, our respective bosses, the president of Nigeria and the president of France, were having their little talk on the side. And the deal that we cut, which was smart, structured, articulate, a good compromise, got swept away by the boys. So watch out as well. So our discussions on the role of women in the economy and the role of trade as a result is coming at a time when we are experiencing geopolitical tensions and the fragmenting of the world trade, which is threatening to roll back decades of advancing the rights of women in relation to economic empowerment. Since the great financial crisis, the global economy has been hit by an unprecedented series of shocks. Anything that could come our way to hit us did come our way to hit us. And this is particularly true in Europe, as you can imagine. And all this has taken its toll on trade growth, which has plateaued as a share of global GDP. We have seen protectionism on the rise, and that could well get worse. Countries are reconfiguring their supply chains to align with new strategic goals. The number of trade restrictions in place has jumped tenfold since the last decade. And you are the ones checking and counting and measuring and alerting the world to this downside. Now, is that to say that we are facing outright deglobalization, as has occasionally been mentioned? I don't think so. Not deglobalization, but probably a change in the nature of globalization as we have known it. We are likely to see more trade within blocs, as countries that share common values and interests deepen their trade ties to increase their resilience to external shocks and threats. And the changing nature of globalization can have implications for women empowerment. Because the rise of global trade has been intricately tied to women's emancipation. In developing countries, firms that trade internationally are also those that employ more women. Women make up a third of the workforce of such firms, compared to less than a quarter for the non-exporting firms. In advanced economies, tariff burdens can at times fall disproportionately on the shoulders of women. In the US, the average tariff rates on products for women are higher than the tariffs on products for men. Interesting, yeah? Overall, countries that are more open to trade tend to have higher levels of gender equality. And that is in part because trade liberalization is linked to a higher accumulation of education and skills for women. So, when we hear that, when we know that, when we care for women's emancipation and participation in the economy, what should we do? We should act in order not only to preserve but to expand the existing achievements won by women's economic empowerment. And we need to ensure that a changing global economy does not introduce new inequalities. So let me mention three sets of action that I think would be appropriate in order to try to maintain and expand the benefits that we've had. First, and that is the role that you play every day, we need to ensure that trade remains as open as possible within the new geopolitical constraints. And this especially applies to maintaining market access for developing countries that should not have to suffer from great power competition. Second, we need to make gender a more substantive component of trade negotiations so that women benefit as much as they should. I know that there are 80 regional or bilateral trade agreements that have at least one provision mentioning gender or women. We need more than those 80. Third, we need to see more women in leadership positions, since that could support trade openness and arrest the slides towards fragmentation. Now, why do I say that? Not to discriminate against men, but simply reading the empirical data-driven work that has been produced, particularly as a result, first, of the great financial crisis, and second, as a result of the great pandemic that we have suffered. Female leaders, they don't have all the skills, all the qualities, granted. But look around you. They tend to have the qualities that are especially beneficial in times of geopolitical tensions. One study in particular finds that they are especially good at thinking holistically, managing complexity, and embracing cooperation, attributes that are ideal when it comes to trade negotiations. I have my way of putting it out. Forgive me. Fewer testosterones, smaller ego. That helps. Look, I've been in that business for 40 years, so I can say that. So, at heart, it's a reciprocal relationship, by the way, because trade can empower women and women can empower trade, and we need to secure that. But we still have some way to go before female leadership becomes as prominent as it needs to be in this world. You may have seen that study recently published, I think it was under the ambit of the United Nations, which indicated that women have held only 12% of the top jobs at the biggest multilateral institutions since 1945. So that has to change. And I have no doubt that together we will get there. There have been many changes. You know, when I was first appointed managing director of the IMF, I looked at the photos. Strings of men. The Bretton Woods agreement in New Hampshire that set up the IMF. Not a single woman, and yet 45 countries represented. When I look around the governing table of my institution, the European Central Bank, we are two women out of 26 people sitting at the table. This is not good enough, and we can do better than that. As a result of which, institutions will benefit. So, as we celebrate International Women's Day, I strongly encourage you to close your eyes, think back of the little girl and then the growing teenager that you were and the dreams that you had. We all went through that phase. Little did you know that you would be sitting in this room. Little did I know that I would become the president of the ECB. So what happened between those probably two small dreams that we had and what you have become and what I have become? Along the way, there were other people that trusted us, that gave us energy and confidence. Some of them were women, some of them were men. But it is that confidence and that energy that you received, that you still receive, that you can also give to others. And now that you've been looking back at your own dreams of the days, think about all the young girls. They might be your daughters, they might be your granddaughters. There might be students that you come across, interns that you work with. Help them with those dreams and make sure, as William Faulkner would have said, that those dreams are big enough so that they don't lose sight of it. You did it. They should be able to do it as well. And we should all work to make sure that this is the case. This is the case for your daughters, for your granddaughters, and all those that you work with. And today, please, smile to each other. It helps always. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Madame Lagarde. That was inspiring, moving, and I'm so excited that I can show this back to my 5.5-year-old daughter at some point and show her that it can absolutely be done. As we celebrate International Women's Day, it is not lost on us just how much work has been done, how much work still needs to be done, and we meet at a very distressing time globally. There's trouble brewing in so many places. We just have to look. And when it comes to issues with the economy, with climate, with anything that has to do with the macroeconomic environment, women are disproportionately impacted. If you had to draw up a balance sheet right now of where we are with equality and women's growth, what would you say? What is your view?
I would say that, look, although we've made some progress, the recent crisis that we've experienced, from the pandemic to the war in Ukraine, with the attendant high energy and food prices, with the existential threat of climate change, I think we've been set back. And actually, some of the numbers bear this out. I think in 2020, before the pandemic really deepened, the World Economic Forum had estimated the amount of time it would take to get gender equality or gender parity to be 100 years. After, given all these crises, the latest estimate is 132. So we've been set back 32 years already. 100 years is so difficult to imagine that my granddaughter's granddaughter, you know, would be there and we may still not have gender equality. But now it's 132 years. The World Bank has estimated that 70 million people have fallen into absolute poverty because of this. And the Oxfam is saying that 47 million people in poverty are women and girls. So when you look at all of this in terms of impact, I feel we've been set back. And it's going to take us another decade or more to even catch up to where we were before.
Or more. And Madame Lagarde, here's the reality. Gender equality is fragile. It is fragile and it can be derailed. Can we catch up on those 30 years that we've regressed?
There is progress, not where we want it to be. And girls are still discriminated compared with men or boys. For the advanced economies, I'll tell you how I describe it. I think women, particularly since the COVID hit, have been multitasking with limited assistance. They've been overworked and underpaid. They've been pretty strong entrepreneurial, but very poorly financed. So you can see that there is a series of gaps that need to be addressed and need to be redressed. So for me, it boils down to four L's that I keep repeating myself. So for those of you who've heard me mention the four L's, bear with me, but repetition is part of the game. Law, there are still many countries that some of you represent here that is not equal, where we still have discrimination against women. So that's the first thing that needs to be fixed. Second, learning. Girls have to be educated, need to be given access to education, and special efforts need to be made in that respect. That's not the case everywhere in the world, far from it. Third, labor, access to the job market and equal pay for the same job. Even in the most advanced economies, if you take the Nordic countries out, because they are probably best in class, but if you take those countries out, the gap between a man and a woman is still anywhere between 20 and 14% for the same job. Okay? So that needs to be addressed as well. And the final point, which I made in my remarks, is leadership. We still have too few women in leadership positions, and they can do the job. They can do it better sometimes. So.
Louder, you don't actually need to whisper that. Dr. Ngozi, I mean, it's fascinating. You've done a lot of firsts in terms of ministerial positions, both of you, and of course heading up these very traditional institutions. And it's been incredible to see you at the helm. What have you had to do to change the structure, the ethos, the way that women are firstly viewed within the organization institution, and also when it comes to trade policies? Has it been top of the agenda priority?
Yes, Eleni, absolutely, and it's still a work in progress. So 2 years here, it's a work in progress. I think I pay tribute to my predecessors, but one of the things I discovered when I came is internally we didn't have a gender policy.
Oh, wow.
There was none. I asked about it, and they said there had been one in the making for 7 years, but it had never been made. So the first thing I tried to focus on internally is how can we have an organization of this size and importance? We don't have within our organization, the secretariat, a gender policy. So we worked on it really fast. We set a deadline by which we must have it. And I think everybody knows I'm very results focused. I have to have a deadline, I have to push for results. We got it before we went for Christmas. We got a gender policy. So we have a gender framework now, and we have the elements of how to redress some of the issues concerning women within. And beyond that, looking more at diversity and equity. So beyond even gender, there are other aspects of diversity. So that's one. Second, I want to say that when I came, I also thought just what Christine said. We need to have look at the balance of senior management to begin with, all through the organization, but let me at least begin where I can. And I'm very proud that for the first time in the senior management team of the WTO, we were able to get four fantastic deputies, of which 50% are fantastic women. And they are sitting here in the audience. It was a competition. They didn't walk into the job because they were women. All I did was insist that any shortlist must have at least one woman on it.
Yeah.
I didn't say which woman. And when we did a fair competition, the two women were the top. Among our directors, we have, this is also part of senior management. We have 20. It was a 22% female when I arrived. Mm. We are now at 43%.
Wow.
So we've doubled that. And we've doubled it through competition. I want to repeat this. All I said was there must be women on the shortlist, and I'm going to try to use that to drive the way we do business.
I mean, that's interesting.
Can I just comment on, because I think Ngozi is making such an important point. It goes down to the drilling and the nuts and bolts of how things are done. Because quite often you say, we need equality, 50%. But then you start drilling into the numbers and you disaggregate and you see by segments and you understand better the nature of discrimination. When I was finance minister...
Do you think it's deliberate? It's deliberate
no,
discrimination?
No, well, I was coming to that. I think yes and no. Deliberate in the sense that it requires a bit of an effort.
Yeah.
You know, when I was finance minister in France, I had various big, partly state-owned companies, and I called all the CEOs of those companies, you know, once a year to ask them how the business was doing, how the strategy was, and blah, blah, blah. And I always said, what about your board composition? What is it like, men, women? Invariably, it was predominantly men, in many occasions, only men. And I said, how can that be? I said, oh, I can't find women. I can't. I'm really trying hard. And I said, well, you know what? Why don't you try another year, and maybe next year you will have found some women. They came back the year later, still hadn't found any woman. But in the meantime, I had prepared my own list. So I pulled out my list with about 20 names of women who were competent, qualified, if given a chance, would say yes, and so on and so forth. And that changed the picture. It was not in and of itself sufficient. But you have to really go into the details. And what Ngozi said, which is, I want at least one woman in the shortlist. That is the trick. Because if a woman is given a chance, she will thrive because she has worked much harder than many others to get to where she is.
And it's speaking about getting a deliberate pipeline of leaders of women within organizations and institutions, which seem to be the one of the most important steps in the value chain in getting women to the top of their game.
Yeah, I really want to agree with Christine in that it takes time, and you have to do it in a way that, okay, doesn't men make men feel like you're doing things without merit or that they are being left behind. But invariably, there are just some innate built-in, I don't know whether they're structural, sometimes I say they're structural, sometimes systemic biases that are there. We don't even recognize they're there. And so in order to work against those, you have to build, you have to insist, and you also have to have that pipeline. And sometimes it means looking at the policies of an organization, and we're beginning to do that here too. Sometimes policies look like very innocuous, like they're right. But if the policies keep giving you the same answer, the same time, which is not delivering the change you want, then it means you need to look at them and query, is, are these the right policies? So systems, policies, institutional approach, if you want to change things. So it's not that when Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala leaves, then things go back to where they were. That's not what I'm looking for. I want systemic and structural change so that things can continue and it can be fair for both men and women. That is what we're looking for in the organization.
Is everyone on board with that ethos and philosophy? Any friction we need to know about?
Well, let me say that we have some ways to go. You know, the feedback I get from some of the women is that we, not everybody is on board. Let's just be frank about it. It's not because people are bad or men are bad. No, we have wonderful, productive and fantastic men, male colleagues. Well, sometimes built-in biases can just be there and you don't even know. So we have to really work hard. It will take time. It's 2 years, we are making some differences, but it will take us time. And for women of color, we are talking about women. Yeah. I just want to give a shout out, you know, for women of color in the world, because for everything you find that is difficult, it's doubly difficult for them. So that's another thing we need to work against. People don't, I can even tell you, you know, if you're a woman of color, and Christine, you know, we did this book, of which is a star. When you walk in a room, you can just see the people judging you, especially if you're dressed the way I'm dressed. The first thing is they don't think you have anything intelligent to say.
You're right.
You know, they immediately, innately feel a woman of color has less to say, is less intelligent, and if she's dressed like an African, oh my God, she doesn't look like us. But this is me. It's who I am, and I love it. I just want to end that by saying, look, don't let it bother you, I've never had. I love it. Let them underestimate you.
Yes.
It's good to be underestimated, because then you just take them by surprise.
So we want to know what is in the book that Madame Lagarde was saying.
Here's
so
the women book, in leadership. Christine is a star. Oh, I'm not advertising for you to go and buy it, but it's good, right? For women and leadership, real life, real lessons.
What is the message when you have to engage in these topics, Madame Lagarde? You know, because I think that women, the new generation of leaders, are looking to both of you for advice on how to deal with things, how to go up against some of the tasks that often feel Sisyphean. Mm.
Do exactly what Ngozi said. Be yourself, dress the way you feel comfortable, happy, and proud of, and just be in the room. I think that, you know, I've seen Ngozi in so many situations, and it's not just because of her history and the reputation. There is a way of taking control of a room that you can all have. It's an issue of confidence. For those of you who are interested, by the way, there is a book written by Kathy Kay and Claire Shipman called The Confidence Code, which really identifies very clearly where we are short on confidence and why we are short on confidence. I am still short on confidence, I tell you. And I remember discussing that with Angela Merkel, and she also told me she was short on confidence, which is why we generally super prepare a file, a meeting, we are briefed to the extreme, we know inside out all the details and the numbers and all that, and we spend the whole night before the meeting that we have the following day working and studying. We do that much more so than colleagues. We do. Look at yourself, think about it. And that's to make up for this confidence shortfall that we have, that many of us have, maybe you don't. It comes with age. but it's there. And I think that if you identify the issue, if you appreciate that you have to work on it, it helps going forward. Now, the second thing that I would say, and that I learned from the coach on the national team that I was on when I was 17, is when the going gets tough, grit your teeth and smile. Now, try to do the same thing. Eh? Grit your teeth and smile at the same time. Good luck. But what I mean, what she meant by that, and what I mean by that when I say that to particularly young women, is it will be difficult. There will be obstacles. You have to face them. You have to just get over it and keep going. Keep going. Some people say, don't give up. I say, grit your teeth, smile, get on with it. Just go. Because we have that strength, each and every one of us in this room, men and women alike. And we just have to draw on that to overcome the difficulties that will come our way, no question about it. I want to do a shout out, as Ngozi did, for all women, and women of colors in particular. There is one avenue of training and education where there are so few women that they are given an avenue to join institutions, and that is economics. Try to find women who have degrees and high-level education in macroeconomics, in monetary-related economics. Very, very few. When they are there, I tell you, they are chased, poached, raided. So you have to pick your battle, you have to choose your field, and then you can excel. That's what I would say.
Dr. Ngozi, I want to, you know, weigh in a little deeper into the issue of what women of color experience. And I think this is absolutely vital, and it's absolutely striking. When I travel across the African continent and I meet the most incredible women that are bearing the burden of running a home, are probably the trader in the family. They're involved in informal trading. They are planting so that they can eat. And yet they're excluded from the economic realities, right? If you then propel this person to get a proper education and then eventually get into the workspace, then they also deal with more issues. How are you thinking about tackling this through policy or through mindset change? Or what is that change that needs to occur?
Well, I think it's through both policy and mindset, and through those who are in positions of power actually taking steps to try to change things. First of all, I believe in evidence-based. So the first thing I say to people is there are so many studies. We don't have to prove anything again, and I want to repeat that, because the studies have undoubtedly shown that empowering women is smart economics. It's smart for the family. It is smart for the community, for the country. And women plow so much of their resources back into their family and their community. They educate their children, you know, better, faster, so that this is good for the community. So the first is evidence-based. So I tend to try to quote what there is to show people that we are not just saying it. It's not a good thing to say. It's actual fact. Two is when you are in a policy-making position, for goodness sakes, try to do something with the position you're in. And when I was finance minister, you know, we keep saying we have to do this, we have to do that. And then it struck me Well, your finance minister, you know, you have the budget. You can convince the president that we should do more for women using this instrument. So you have to act at a policy level. So what were the things that we tried to do, for example? We started a program called GWIN, Growing Women and Girls, trying to invest more in women. And an example of this was saying to my colleagues in the cabinet, if you can produce additional results for women, you will get additional budget increment. So we set aside a small part in the budget. So for instance, Aki Adesina, who is now the president of AFDB, got additional budget because he was doing the e-wallet, you know, trying to get women access to pesticides and fertilizer faster. And he was able to include 2 million more women on this e-wallet. We gave him additional budget. For the health sector, when they did more results, we gave them budget. So we used the budget as an instrument. I remember the president announcing this when he was presenting the budget in parliament. And of course, then, you know, there was a bit of an uproar from the men. But in the end, it prevailed. And this produced results at a macro level. So I believe in using your policy instruments to do that. Supporting women entrepreneurs through the UWIN program, we also try to do that. And then on a micro level, I also believe in, by the way, I believe that if you change the life of one person through your action, that is powerful. Don't think that it always has to be at a global level or at a big level. Even one person whose life you can change by mentoring, by assisting. So you also try at a micro level to do what you can to change the lives of other people. And I've tried to do that.
But do you need women in these roles to make these big decisions on this?
Yeah.
Or are men going to be making these decisions as well? Because you went through the numbers, right, of the percentage of men or women in multinational institutions, mostly men.
Too many, yeah. You know, I don't think that it is deliberate on the part of men to ignore the women, but it's just sometimes it doesn't cross their desk, it doesn't cross their mind. And I remember when I was finance minister too, there was a clear issue of crédit à la consommation, so consumers' credit, which invariably targeted women. And it's a sad reality, but the financial literacy of women is certainly smaller than that of men. And they were wonderful targets and praise by some credit institutions. So we had to put in place a policy in order to protect the women that were the targets of those advertising campaign, of those marketing campaign by credit institutions, to warn them about the consequences of taking too many consumers' credit at a time and end up in actual bankruptcy situation. Now, I had a really tough time convincing my treasury officials that it was necessary, it was helpful, it was needed for the stability of finances, not just for those women, but of the financial system at large. It took a while, I can assure you. And I still have, you know, former colleagues of those days who say, oh, yes, I remember your bankruptcy and crédit à la consommation reform. Oh, la, la. But it really was helpful. And it put those credit institutions on their guards that they couldn't just, you know, have those very deceptive and not properly informed campaigns and decisions as a result. So that is one area that colleagues, males, had not experienced because they were not confronted to it. And that's where you can add a new dimension.
I feel like there's a whole bunch of education in this. Yes.
Yeah. Can I just jump in on the men? You know, I
please.
On the issue of the men, no, I say to women, we shouldn't also just be talking to each other. Because we can't do it alone. And I want to say that men can do a lot. There's a role. Two of the presidents I served in Nigeria were good in terms of getting women in cabinet. The first president, President Obasanjo, increased the number of women in cabinet to 16%. President Goodluck Jonathan doubled that number to 33%. He not only doubled it, he gave the women the most important posts: finance, defense, aviation, education, petroleum. He did that. I'm not saying that everybody performed marvelously, but his intent was to show that it's not just about the women being in cabinet, but also they can do the crucial jobs. And he wasn't that popular for it. So men can act, and men have a role. Men, in my life, many women have been fantastic mentors to me, but so have men. Mm. And some of the chances I got came from men who believed in me. And I have to say that there was my former boss, Moin Qureshi, who was managing director. There was Jim Wolfenson, who was president of the World Bank. There was Bob Zelik. Some of my bosses just had so much confidence in me that I could waltz around the place. They thought I could do whatever, you know. So that really helped. So men can do that. And my father, I always joke to people, my father had 2 daughters and 5 sons. And I know my brothers, if they hear this, may say maybe you're exaggerating, but my sister and I believed he expected so much of the girls. He thought we could do anything. And we always used to joke that he expected less of the boys and more of the girls. So men can be critical.
Final thoughts, how you're feeling about the future, what the next step is for you, what the future of my child will be, my girl child. What can she look forward to?
Well, you know, for someone like me who is an optimist by nature and who never says never, I'm not feeling so good these days. I'm really, really concerned that we are sleepwalking into potential world conflict. And my focus is, what can I do about it so as to save us? We see what is happening. People are dying. I lived through a war for 3 years. Well, from the time I was 12 till I was 15. So war to me is not an academic issue. I lived through it, eating 1 meal a day, sometimes not eating, running from place to place. My parents lost everything. So it's not academic. When I see the pictures, it hurts. So my question to myself is, what can you control? What can you do? And trying to see whether this organization, what we can do, work supporting members to try to help with food prices, to try to help with trade, to keep it open, to whatever we can do to be supportive of a more peaceful world where people have enough to eat and, you know, a place to sleep. That's what I worry about, the fundamentals for ordinary people. And then just praying that we won't get into a world where my granddaughter, you know, will have to witness the war that I witnessed when I was growing up. Mm.
Madame Lagarde.
Despite everything that I feel, just like Ngozi, I have ultimate faith in each and every one of us. Mm. And I have seen many instances, circumstances, where one single individual, one single woman, one single man, can actually change the map, can change the scene. So each and every one of us, we can do something where we are. And sometimes it goes beyond us, and there is a higher call, and you have to just move and say yes, as we just did when you asked the question. I mean, for how many years was there no agreement at all at the WTO? And I'm not putting the blame on any of the predecessors of Ngozi. But suddenly somebody gets in, gets stuck, wants the data, is prepared to cooperate, wants to lay a ground where people will actually talk to each other, and something gets agreed. That's what I have inside me that gives me faith that, of course, we can improve the situation if we put our mind to it and if we believe a little bit up there as well, as I do. But that inside each and every one of us, there is enough good to take us further into something that will be nice for my granddaughter, your grandchildren, And so yours one day, because don't worry, that is something which happens all the time, the passing of time.
And then I have to have energy to look after my grandchild. Thank you to all of you for joining us today. A big thank you to the Director General of the World Trade Organization, Dr. Nkosi Okonjo-Iweala, and Madame Christine Lagarde, the President of the European Central Bank. Thank you so much. Round of applause, ladies and gentlemen.
If you'd like to watch the full event, check out the link in the show notes. Additionally, the WTO, in collaboration with the International Trade Center, recently launched a fund to support women exporters in acquiring digital skills to expand their client base and better leverage trade and the global economy. You can find more information in the show notes as well. We'll be back soon with Let's Talk Trade.